with over 25 years of experience integrating mental health and spirituality, the author of Reclaiming Authenticity, When Ancestors Weep, and Redeeming the Bereaved. Here is Dr. James Houck.
Good afternoon, everyone, wherever you are in the world at this time. Welcome to Reclaiming Authenticity, reclaiming that which has always been in you. I am very excited to be with you here today at a new time now. Fridays at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, Eastern Standard Time, and noon Pacific Time. And before we get underway with today's topic, I wanted to start off today's broadcast with a special acknowledgement of everyone who has been affected by the events of 9/11. And it's hard to believe that it's been 19 years since that fateful day when so many people suffered and died as a result of the attacks from terrorists. And since then, I have to say that I've seen a lot of suffering and grief, and I've also seen tremendous courage and compassion from people from all walks of life. In fact, there are still many, many families who grieve the loss of their loved ones who died that day. And still, there are many, many people who struggle to make sense of such tragedies in light of what's going on in the world today. And one of the aspects of suffering through national tragedies, and I've discovered just over the years, just counseling others, is that it really affects everyone down to the smallest towns and the smallest communities in our nation. I don't think anything that happened on September 11, 2001 unaffected anybody, no matter where they were in the United States. Everybody was glued to a radio or a TV or the internet or something. It was just unbelievable as we just shook our heads and just, how much worse can this get? And yet, with every loss that we experience in our lives and every disappointment, every tragedy that we're faced with, sooner or later, they all present us with this one challenge, and it's this. Will this experience make me bitter, or will this experience somehow, in some way, sometime, make me better? And this is where I find most people struggling between the two. You know, do we allow personal tragedies to allow others to keep taking from us? You know, taking from us our sanity or our peace or even the very best of ourselves. Because many people ask me, well, how do you do this? How do you go from being bitter to better? And I flip the question around. I just intentionally do this to get them to look in other ways. And instead of it's a this or that question, just helping people understand that there is so much more to us than what we have become so far. And, you know, the best in us, who we are deep in our core, deep within our soul. Just exactly who are we? And this is what reclaiming authenticity is all about, you know, finding the courage to reclaim that which has always been in you from the very, very beginning. And this is what makes us better in the face of atrocities, when we are able to go much deep, deep, deep within ourselves and find those core traits, those core characteristics, and we find that the very best of us can come out. Well, it is my great pleasure to be with you here this day. I hope that wherever you are on this 19 years later of 9/11, you are safe and you are at peace. And how is your heart today? I am Dr. James Houck, and if you would like more information about me or to leave me your comments about today's show, please do, because I enjoy reading your comments. You can visit www.bbsradio.com/reclaiming authenticity. That's www.bbsradio.com/reclaiming authenticity. And if you want to be a part of the show today, feel free to call in. Call the number 888-627-6008. That's 888-627-6008. And just in case you miss any or all of these broadcasts, they are podcasted. In case you want to go back and listen again, or you can go back into the archives and listen to previous shows. And again, you can just visit the website and you'll be directed where you would find these podcast broadcasts. Okay. Well, I'll be taking your calls in a little bit because I really want to hear from you on today's subject. It's an interesting subject indeed. The title might be a little off-putting for people, but hopefully they understand as I go on to explain. This show is entitled Blood That Cries Out, and it's related to intergenerational trauma, blood that cries out. And this is something that I was never taught about when I went to school. It's just something I just kind of backed into in learning about intergenerational trauma. And I started to hear the cries of others within my dreams. And I started to hear the cries of others in my heart. And I realized that I was not only listening to the cries of those who are living presently, but I was also hearing the cries of those who have been wounded and killed in previous generations. And so it's this notion of the blood cries out. But I'll have more to say about this here shortly. So I just want to begin by sharing a little story with you to kind of have us, just segue into what is intergenerational trauma? What's this all about? And maybe this is the first time you're actually hearing that phrase. And most people understand what trauma is. But when you put the word intergenerational, what does that do to it? What do we mean? Okay. Well, as I share this story, you'll get the idea of what intergenerational trauma is all about. This must have happened probably a good 6-7 years ago. It was a crisp, sunny November morning. Know it well. My Native American Indian friends and I drove from Philadelphia to the former site of the Carlisle Indian Industrial Boarding School. And they were in town for a fundraiser, and they wanted to see this school since their only knowledge of the place was from the stories that they had been told or that they had read about. Now, Native American Indian boarding schools have always been a sensitive subject with my friends, as they recall the horrific stories told to them by their tribal grandmothers and grandfathers when they were younger. And this is rightly so, because several of these experiences have plagued their ancestors with physical or psychological and even spiritual scars that are a constant reminder of how others view their so-called savage and uncivilized race. That is something that they had struggled with growing up. Just a lot of people would want to put that label back on them. And again, this was a form of prejudice. What people were saying, just a form of racism that once, agencies or a group of people way back in the day had started referring to Native American Indians this way, it never really went away, unfortunately. And I know a lot of Native American friends still struggle with having to really convince others that, this label does not apply to them. Okay. In fact, it never applied to any Native American Indian. Well, ironically, in spite of that, we also need to go back throughout history and look at the patterns of prejudice and cruelty and mistreatment. This isn't, not exclusive to Native American Indians, but it also extends to any gender or race or class or ethnicity or nationality, etc., in which a society and its systems, whether it be the governmental, educational, religious, or science, etc., when in a society and its systems categorize people as unworthy or untouchable, or unlovable. Now, today, as well as decades ago, many people look to place specific blame for such brutality. And yet, who's at fault? I mean, who do you prosecute for such crimes against humanity? Can certain individuals be singled out, whether or not they are living these days, or does blame belong to communities in general? I'm sure you've all heard of the ancient African proverb that states that it takes a village to raise a child. Well, just as it takes a village to raise a child, so too does it take a village to perpetuate the physical, emotional, and spiritual atrocities. In fact, no one acts alone. Now, surprisingly, you lovers of history, you may or may not remember, but Adolf Hitler also acknowledged this phenomenon early in his life. He writes, "Even in those days, I saw that there was a twofold method by which alone it would be possible to bring about an amelioration of these such living conditions." He says, "The first method is to create better fundamental conditions of social development by establishing a profound feeling of social responsibilities among the public. And then, secondly, combine this feeling for social responsibilities with a ruthless determination to prune away all excesses which are incapable of being improved." And of course, he was talking about people that he labeled as undesirables. Again, it's interesting that this was brewing in Hitler's life even as a young man. So it is true. It does take a village to raise a child, but it also takes a village to perpetuate any kind of physical, emotional, or spiritual atrocities. And this is what intergenerational trauma is all about. It's the trauma that succeeding generations feel and experience based on what, let's say, parents felt, or grandparents, or even great-grandparents, or even going back further. It's somehow carried down through the genes, and as well it's carried down in how society continues to behave against people that they deem as unlovable or untouchable. Okay? So, yet as more and more of these historical atrocities emerge from those whose cries reach our own souls, villages and communities may still want to hide their heads in the sand and pretend not to see or not to hear or to speak no evil. However, the time has come that we can no longer pretend that we are not part of systems that produce and perpetuate the mistreatment of others. I mean, we all have to ask ourselves, is what I'm doing, am I being complicit in some way? I mean, that's a very honest question for anyone. Is what I think, how I speak, what do I feel, and my behavior, am I contributing to the continued mistreatment of others? Well, as I said earlier, my friends and I went to the former Carlisle boarding school, and when we were standing in the middle of the boarding school gravesite, my friends and I were struck by the diversity of Native American Indian children that we identified by the white gravestones. And if you've ever been to the former Carlisle Native American Indian boarding school, you know what I'm talking about, because there are many, many, many little white gravestones. And as we were walking around, it was a very solemn experience for all of us. And as I said, we identified many Native American children by these white gravestones and what were chiseled on them. And among the children buried there were Cherokee and Lakota, Sioux, Inuit, Apache, Pueblo, Seminole, and many other tribal nations. About a third of the gravestones, however, were marked unknown, representing unidentified children. And as we walked around, we blessed each grave with tobacco and sage offerings and said a prayer, and we all honored them who were buried there by not referring to them as children, but instead referring to them as the grandmothers and grandfathers, as ancestors. And in this one act of prayer, we basically unraveled Captain Richard Pratt's philosophy of we need to kill the Indian to save the man. You see, it was Pratt's philosophy as he was in charge of the Carlisle boarding school. He really fueled a nation's behavior of assimilating Indians into the European ways by forced location of children, stripping them of their names and stripping them wearing traditional clothing or how they wore their hair, forbid them to speak their native language or observe their religion and other native customs. And thousands of children were portrayed as having been assimilated into the American culture in that historical picture setting on the grass in front of Pratt's homes and headquarters. All you would need to Google the Carlisle boarding school, and sooner or later you're going to see that old black and white picture of all the Native American Indian children sitting on this huge, huge field just right in front of Pratt's home. And as we stood on that grassy lawn and we realized where we were standing, my friends were deeply moved as they proudly proclaimed through their tears that Pratt had failed because we Indians are still here. See, the truth never stays buried because humanity cannot, has not, and will never be able to annihilate who people truly are. And that's soul. The reason for this is because when people struggle with trauma, it has the potential to disconnect us from who we are as soul. And this is because trauma often places this distorted template over our own perceptions. Think about it this way. Trauma says to us, well, this is all there is. This is all there is to you. This is as good as it gets. And all the lies and distortions that come from other wounded people who have yet to embrace themselves as soul. In fact, once we embrace ourselves as soul, we could be really astonished to see the power of our soul to not only transcend our own trauma and transform the wounded energy, but also empower others to do the same. And this is what keeps us from being bitter. This is what helps make us better. But still, as history teaches, many people have feared the resiliency and the power of the soul, and therefore have often tried to silence its cry, you know, through killings and murders, genocide, starvations, forced assimilations, humiliations, degradations, looking at people as savages or primitive, backward, or seeing people as unlovable, unworthy, and therefore disposable as those in control saw fit. Well, what's heartbreaking to me, as I sit with a lot of people, is that these atrocities have often been committed in the name of God. They've been committed, you know, in the name of God by people who should see themselves as soul. In fact, even when killing is done in the name of God, the only thing that is truly advanced is the distorted view from those who will do anything to hang on to their power. There was a time when I had met Kevin Annett. He's the founder of the International Tribunal on the Crimes of Church and State. And he had shared with me at one point that he says, you know, when we believe that God's on our side, we can commit any crime. We are absolved individually from that crime by believing we have a higher sanction. And he says that's the danger of any religion that gets out of hand. It allows people to believe they can do that, to commit any crime in God's name if we think God's on our side. Well, ironically, the blood spilled and throughout history of violence against one another is never silent. the cries of the blood and the soul certainly reach heaven, and crying out to every succeeding generation to heed its voice and to reconcile their suffering. And there's particularly one account of this phenomena recorded in the Bible. It's actually the story that comes in Genesis. It's the story of Adam and Eve, and Eve giving birth to her sons, Cain and Abel. And she says that the Lord had taken away her shame when he had given her two sons. And according to the scripture, you know, Abel was the one who kept the flocks and Cain worked the soil, or I'm assuming a farmer. And in the course of time, Cain brought some of the fruit of the soil as an offering to the Lord. And Abel also brought an offering, fat portions from some of the firstborn flock. And the Lord looked with favor on Abel and his offering, but on Cain, his offering, he didn't look with favor. So Cain became very angry, and his face was downcast. And this is when God said to Cain, "Why are you angry? Why is your face downcast? If you do what is right, will you not be accepted? But if you do not do what is right, sin is definitely crouching at your door." And then Cain said to his brother Abel, "Let's go out into the field." And when they were in the field, Cain attacked his brother Abel, and he killed him. And then the Lord said to Cain, "Where is your brother Abel?" "Well, I don't know," he replied. "Am I my brother's keeper?" And the Lord said, "What have you done? Listen, your brother's blood cries out to me from the ground." And then the rest of the story unfolds from there. And so we do have an account of how the blood, the life in the blood, cries out for a reconciliation, cries out. And regardless of the geography, lands that have witnessed humanity's atrocities against one another have not only absorbed numerous blood-soaked traumas, but also the energy from such traumas have stained the souls of victims and perpetrators who have been unable to free themselves. In fact, few people realize that the souls are being continuously held in, shall we say, the tar pits of traumatic energy through ancestral stories or annual remembrances and celebrations that emotionally, psychologically, and spiritually rewound the souls of one generation after generation. But today, as lovers of history, you know, many people are caught up in the stories of how people died tragically at the hands of others. In fact, some of these stories often become sensationalized plots for movies or other forms of entertainment. And despite this awareness of humanity's stories, many people are often ill-equipped to offer any kind of solace for these souls, let alone their own, impacted by the energetic cycle of intergenerational trauma. The reason for this is because these stories are always told from a place of woundedness and hardly ever from a place of healing. And this is what keeps us stuck. This is how we can become very bitter. We tell these stories from a place of woundedness, not a place of healing. This is something that I had learned at a very young age. I had heard my family's stories just over and over and over again, whether it's at the dinner table or a picnic table or some other family gathering. And I really took notice on just how my family told stories. I mean, I could, you know, tell the stories verbatim. I had it memorized already, heard it so often. But I listened carefully to the tone that my family used in telling these stories. I even knew where they were going to laugh. I even knew where they were going to tear up. I even knew when they started to get angry, and so on and so forth. And it really didn't hit home with me, you know, about how the way I was telling my family stories, because I got caught up in the energy too of telling our family stories from a place of woundedness instead of a place of healing. And just invite you to listen to the stories that other people share, that other people tell you, or you listen to, or you overhear. Listen for the tone. Are they telling this story from a place of woundedness, or are they telling it from a place of healing? Well, over the years, I've learned that trying to discuss death has always been an interesting topic to, you know, for people. And no other subject except for, say, politics and religion pushes so many of our physical, emotional, and even spiritual buttons. And whereas some people are fascinated by the topic of death, others avoid the mere mention of it because it's as if talking about death would jinx their life. But still, what I've discovered in counseling others is that the majority of people avoid death because they cannot bear the thought of being separated from loved ones and friends. In other words, this gripping fear around death, this loss and grief can also act like an unrelenting vice that squeezes out our life just like a tangled web of vipers. For as much as we're gripped by the fear of death, there's something even stronger. And that's the sound of our own soul's cry to be connected to God and to stay connected. As a young boy, I believe God put this prayer in my heart to hear the cries of others. And whenever I would be in a crowd or a part of a chaotic cheering noise, it was strange because these voices would blend together and sound like one collective painful cry. I thought I was going crazy, but I soon discovered that I was not listening with my ears, but listening with my soul. And eventually, this cacophony soon became the foundation from which I would be praying for others. Interestingly, down through the centuries, cultures and societies have also heard the voices of millions and millions of souls that not only cry from the depths of their trauma, but also cry out for justice. They cry out for healing. They cry out for redemption and peace. Well, I would really love to hear your heart on these matters. So again, if you would like to call in, the number is 888-627-6008, and I'll be taking your calls after the break. Again, you are listening to Reclaiming Authenticity, and I am your host, Dr. James Haupt. I'll be back with you in 1 minute. Well, welcome back. I am Dr. James Hauck, excuse me, and you're listening to Reclaiming Authenticity. Again, just a quick word about next week's show. We're going to stay on this topic of intergenerational trauma. This is something that, there are many, 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 many layers to it. So we could certainly spend between now and the end of the year just on intergenerational trauma. But next week, the show is going to focus on just what exactly does it mean that it takes a village to hide, help, and heal abuses? And so we're going to look at the communal aspect of intergenerational trauma, as well as look at some atrocities that were done in the name of God or in the name of something else. And I'll share with you several of my stories of how I was able to walk the land and realize that something traumatic had happened here. Some places are certainly more well known than others, But still, it's like, how do we change the energy of what had happened in a particular place, whether it be a battlefield or genocide or some other mass grave? Well, in the first half of the broadcast, we've been talking about how energy and trauma and blood just remain in the ground, and how that blood or that trauma, the traumatic energy, cries out. The soul cries out to be reconnected with God. It cries out for this reconciliation, this healing of what the atrocities had been done, and just this mass traumatic way in which many, many people had died. And graves, on one hand, may acknowledge the lives who once existed in a certain place and time, but the soul is not bound by time or space and dimension. Graves may hold the remains of the physical bodies that have been mutilated or charred or violated and hidden, but graves, marked or otherwise, have never been able to hold the soul. We live on. Therefore, when we look at our blood, we acknowledge those who have come before us and those who have come after us. They're right there in our DNA. And the interconnectedness, the evidence for this interconnectedness, is in the soul and the blood that holds the truth of not only what we collectively have been through, but also who we are collectively. I strongly believe that humanity is at a stage in its cycle that is being called to awaken to this truth and reconnect with God on a higher conscious level of the soul. Because generations and generations after the Native American Carlisle boarding school closed its doors in 1918, it's true. Native Americans are still here, still enduring the memories of endless suffering of their people. And interestingly, over 10,000 Native American children from about 140 tribes attended the Carlisle boarding school. But according to the author Hunt, about only 158 students graduated. And that's always just a point of contention between a lot of people. Just the numbers don't add up. So it leaves the question, where are the others? Did they run off? Were they killed? Did they just die of diseases, illness, or sickness? But still, there's this significant amount that are left unaccounted for. But still, mass graves of both Native and non-Native people are being uncovered throughout the world. Generations and generations from other indigenous schools are coming forward with eyewitness stories of abuse and death that have scarred both their memories and their bodies. And as a result, government and often ecclesiastical bodies scramble to offer apologies and, want to set up truth and reconciliation commissions to perhaps maybe on one level get to the bottom of it, but more than likely to ease their consciousness. Yet, I always have to ask the question, when we discover such tragedies had existed, are apologies enough? Are apologies enough? Some people would say, no, they're not enough, not when corrupt systems and illegal practices and personal entitlements are still evident today. Well, as I mentioned, this ancient African proverb states that it takes a village to raise a child. And, quite frankly, the survival of any people extends beyond the immediate family. And regardless of nationality or creed or race, we are more connected to one another than what we truly, truly realize. However, it just takes, just as it takes many to contribute to the development of a generation of children, history also shows us, that it also takes a village to hide scandals, to hide abuses, and hide atrocities. Okay? No one person or entity acts alone. No secret has ever remained hidden, and no truth ever stays buried. Yes, in one way, we could look at it this way. Dead men and women and children do tell tales of how they died. Some, yes, died of natural causes, and some died at the hands of others, and some people were not even considered worthy to be buried respectively. But for all of these atrocities and more, isn't it time for us to begin telling the stories of how they lived? It's time for us to see them for who they are, souls. Souls that live on after their hearts have stopped beating and the brain waves have ceased. Souls that surround us like that cloud of witnesses or communion of the saints, if you prefer. And our ancestors, whether or not you are a Native American Indian or whatever your heritage is, our ancestors are speaking to us constantly through the blood that runs through our veins. Yet, how do we reconcile these events with what we do today? And this is the real effort behind healing intergenerational trauma. Quite often, Native American Indians are forced to carry their scars on the inside, which are not so easily visible except for, what people would point to and say, well, you see, there's alcoholism or there's homelessness, there's drug use, there's crime, there's suicide. And then you and I both know that these are not exclusive to our Native American Indians. It just seems like these things cut across all cultures. Yet if we look closely below the surface of such behavior, the alcoholism, homelessness, drug use, crime, suicide, we discover emotional and spiritual symptoms of, let's say, trauma that has never been healed, or more specifically, of the boarding school trauma, and this hopelessness, or depression, or anxiety, or mistrust, or nightmares, sadness, hypervigilant, etc., etc. But ironically, these symptoms are also appearing in Native American youth who are at least one, two, three, even four, maybe five generations removed from such boarding school experiences. And this phenomenon, of course, leads us to really wrestle with these questions. How is it possible that children and grandchildren, even great-grandchildren, are experiencing the same emotional, psychological, and spiritual symptoms as their ancestors, who in person experienced boarding school-related rape or murder or starvation or molestation? Are these children and grandchildren simply over-identifying, perhaps, with the stories communicated by their ancestors? And are the traumatic experiences locked somewhere in the DNA of survivors only to be passed down later? And are traumatic symptoms modeled from one generation to another? Well, the answer is yes. Simply not over-identifying with the stories, but traumatic experiences are handed down through the DNA. This is something that we know in just looking at the subject of eugenics, something I talked about last week, but also in very traumatic ways, symptoms are modeled from one generation to another because the traumatic event has never been healed. The people who went through it have never been healed. And so there is this identification that this happened to my ancestors, this happened to my forefathers and foremothers, and happened to my parents, and therefore, because I'm in the family line, it must be true because I kind of feel this way too. And it's kind of like this vicarious people picking up trauma that is not theirs, but yet they still feel it. For these symptoms that they are experiencing are very true, are very real. Well, the history of humanity has often been riddled with traumatic experiences. I mean, their physical, emotional, psychological, and spiritual injuries have been well documented through the ages. And in earlier times, these perceptions and behaviors have been perceived by many in society to be kind of odd or eccentric. more often described as humanity's madness, but they may have actually been an inability to cope with prolonged physical, emotional, or psychological illness and distress. For the most part, I believe people can handle their daily stressors. I believe, for the most part, people can cope with anxiety. I believe, for the most part, that people are able to manage situational depression in healthy ways. In fact, people are able to excel at these coping mechanisms because they have built up this internal hardiness. I mean, call it wisdom or faith or perseverance, whatever. These traits not only enable people to learn from the majority of their negative experiences by reflection, but also they have learned to thrive and go beyond or transcend their so-called physical, psychological, emotional, and spiritual limitations. Moreover, having resiliency means much more than rising above that which doesn't kill me. And in its original context, resiliency means the ability to be able to return to an original state or form after being compressed. For example, let's say if someone is stretched, we would say that its resiliency lies in its elasticity, like a rubber band. Okay, so if something is stretched, we would say that it, because of the elasticity, it will go back to its original shape. Okay, like that rubber band that's snapping back after it's been pulled. And in mental health circles, we have many images of resiliency that distressed people often are encouraged to become like, such as a willow tree, something that can bend even in the strongest storms, but not break. Now, long before much scholarly research was done on resiliency, martial arts expert Bruce Lee, way back in 1975, he encouraged people to be like water. He says that water is a substance that fits into any container, yet has the power to maintain its property, H2O, even as a liquid, a solid, or gas. It is this fact that water is able to adapt to any situation without being destroyed, which provides us an excellent object lesson for resiliency. Yet, these images of, say, the rubber band and the willow tree, are they able to really capture the essence of resiliency when it comes to us, our physical, emotional, psychological, and spiritual losses? Well, not quite. You see, the rubber band and the willow tree do possess a degree of elasticity, that is, being able to be stretched and bend when they're met with an external force. However, what's often overlooked is that we are forever shaped by our losses and our traumatic experiences. However, we can never go back to the way things were. We're able to, bend during an emotional storm, yes, but we're never going to retain our original shape, metaphorically speaking. Because this is one of the things that is just the uniqueness of the different experiences. They have an impact on us, and when something traumatic comes our way, we're just never the same. Because for every change people experience in their lives, they also experience a sense of having lost someone or something they once had. This is the basic definition of bereavement. And most people I have counseled want to hit the rewind button and go back to the way things were before they experienced any kind of pain or loss or even trauma. And although this is a reasonable request, something that is like, I would like to do that too, going back to the way things used to be is just not possible, because our losses shatter our assumptions and perceptions about ourselves. They shatter our assumptions about others, and they shatter our assumptions about the world in which we live. In other words, everything that we have known up until that point has now been altered. It has been changed. We simply cannot look at the world through the same lens. I often hear this from many people who still talk about that fateful day of 9/11. You know, they know exactly where they were. They know exactly who they were talking to. They know exactly the emotions that gripped them when they realized what exactly was going on. And yet, they can never go back to the way things were. And they often describe, before 9/11, 2001, our lives were this way. We were kind of naive to the whole thing, or we were unaware, or we never even thought something like this could happen to us. But after 9/11, we kind of knew better. You know, it's like, oof, you know, this can happen to us. This did happen to us. And, you know, it's not just that change of that perception, but how we look at our world, our worldview is just, it's been forever altered. Okay. And instead of by broadening our understanding of resiliency, we recognize our potential to adapt or persevere and change even in the present moment. And we all have this ability. You know, we all have come into the world with this already gifted and graced in us. We become more and more aware of this capacity, though, when our resiliency grows as a result of hindsight, which in turn then prepares us for other moments in which we must adapt and persevere. And to illustrate this point, I heard a very lovely quote from Wilma Mankiller. She was the first female chief of the Cherokee Nation. She once remarked that she said, "Cows run away from the storm while the buffalo charges towards it, and it gets through it quicker." She says, "Whenever I'm confronted with a tough challenge, I don't prolong the torment. I become the buffalo." All of us need to recognize that such strength lies within all of us. Unfortunately, I hear a lot of people who define themselves by their negative experiences and misunderstanding the language of resiliency, and thereby perpetuate a kind of a defeatist attitude that dictates their outlook on life. This is just something that it's difficult to help the person see what they are doing, because so often we are looking to understand who we are, and we often look externally at circumstances or situations or different kinds of experiences to say, well, if it wasn't for that, I wouldn't be here. If it wasn't for this, I wouldn't be there. And again, it's becomes often an excuse that we all could fall into this trap of just saying, this is just the way my life is unfolding here, when it's just simply not that. Because if you've been listening to this broadcast or these broadcasts for a while now, you've heard me say on more than one occasion that I'm a firm believer that humanity possesses incredible resiliency. In fact, at times, let's admit it, we have to be reminded of our inner strength and our perseverance. We have to be reminded that we already possess these things coming into this world. But when we look externally at the things that have happened around us, we tend to shrink back and say, oh, what are we going to do? What can I do? But given enough time and support and encouragement, we can handle most anything that comes our way. We might even surprise ourselves and others just how resourceful we are. But nevertheless, even though we've had our shining moments when we can rise to the occasion, so to speak, we're also going to have our breaking points when we can no longer keep ourselves together due to the inability to withstand the relentless assault on our inner resources. But still, the physical, emotional, psychological pain can be excruciating at times. But when we embrace our true selves as soul, we find the strength to rise above the pain. Oh, we're always going to have the memory. We're always going to remember what has happened to us. But again, how do we tell these stories? Do we tell these stories from that place of pain, Or do we tell that those stories from a place of now, let's say, wisdom, or now from a place of healing, or now from a place of peace? This is not allowing trauma then to define us. Well, perhaps we all know people who have suffered tremendously with physical pains and ailments. Their bodies are racked daily, daily agony. Yet within them, there's this sweet disposition, a healthier outlook, and a beautiful soul that can never be silenced by the physical or the emotional pain that they might be suffering. And these are the people I find fascinating. These are the people that I want to talk to. These are the people who just by being in their presence, we come away transformed. We come away changed for the better. We're reminded of the strength and resiliency of the soul. And helping generations heal from traumatic issues in which they had learned either a mistrust or internalized these skewed perceptions which affected their attachments or cognitive development or social interactions does have a multidimensional and a multigenerational effect. Yet when generations of a family are able to come together and address these issues, they quickly realize that healing such wounds is not a matter of placing blame, but instead understanding the impact of what has been handed down through the generations. I've shared with this audience before that when I share this with kids and teenagers that I counsel, and they're sitting with me and they're wondering, like, why do I have to deal with this? It didn't even start with me. Whatever the issue is in the family, where the family would want to label the child as the problem or the issue, first thing that I work with the young adult on, the teenager, is on, let's correct that perception. You're right. It didn't start with you. And perhaps for some reason, those who've come before you, family members and grandparents, and let's go back even further, the great-grandparents or however far back you want to go, were unable to heal whatever had happened to them. They were unable to, let's say, stay away from alcohol or drugs or whatever it was that was handed down. Perhaps they really struggled with a lot of anger and rage due to being sexually or emotionally abused or even physically abused. But sooner or later, the teenager realizes that it didn't start with them, but yet they are often the strongest one in the family to be able to heal this. Because as they're healing themselves, they heal others because of how they perceive others, how they perceive themselves, how they interact with themselves, how they talk to themselves, how do they talk to others, and so forth. And we can just see this just by listening to the tone that people use all the time and listening to our tone. Is there something about our tone of voice or something about the way we treat others that really comes from that place deep within us of peace and healing and wholeness? Or are we talking and treating others from that place of woundedness that has never been healed, but is still crying out to be healed? This is the empowerment that people living here and now can embrace. That yes, you can be the strongest one in your family to heal intergenerational trauma. And I'll be the first one to say, okay, let's be honest here, it's not going to be easy. It is not going to be easy. Because to face wounds and pain and suffering, and not just the stories, but also knowing where all that pain comes from. There could be certain backlash, you face from your families, or you could be overcome. But even taking the first step to say, this will heal in me, and I will not carry it forward, that begins a tremendous step in healing intergenerational trauma. And because, for the most part, healing is a matter of unlearning the generational lessons that have been affected with what family members have believed about themselves as well as these perceptions that have been handed down from one generation after another. And even if one's parents and grandparents are deceased, healing can still be achieved by understanding the dynamics of trauma that's been handed down throughout the family. And so this is part of the task of healing from intergenerational wounds. I'm Dr. James Houck. You've been listening to Reclaiming Authenticity, and I invite you to tune in next Friday, 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, noon Pacific Time, and next week we'll be taking a closer look at healing intergenerational trauma. Until then, take care and God bless.
For an answer, or just to leave 1,000 comments, or prodding to buy a book by Dr. Houck, it's all there. Just wander on over to ReclaimingAuthenticity.com and click around. And we'll see you next Tuesday at 4 p.m. Pacific Time on BBS Radio.